That old black magic has me in its spell. Old black magic that you weave so well.
My name is Richard Cortez. I am a jazz vocalist based in New York City. I consider myself a song stylist of the Great American Songbook. I'm a historian of this music who loves the lyrics so much, and I put a lot of emphasis on deep emotional performances and interpretations of the work of Cole Porter, George Gershwin, Ira Gershwin, Harold Arlen, and the like.
So let me ask you this, like, what was the music you were exposed to when you were coming up, and what kind of tugged your ear, made you aware of the Great American Songbook?
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper.
When I was a young boy, my grandmother looked after me a great deal, and that was her favorite music. So she used to sit me in front of the television, and she used to have something called a laser disc player. Yeah. It's sort of like a huge DVD that's in like a cardboard container, and you like launch it into this player and pull it out and it plays movies. But basically she would put me in front of the TV as a little boy, and she would play all of these old Hollywood movies. And so while I did not go into singing jazz until much later in my life, my mid-30s was when I started singing jazz, I was exposed to all of this material. So this music has been a peripheral part of my life since I was a child.
That's rather late to decide to dedicate yourself to jazz as a profession. What ultimately made that decision come about?
Well, I met a jazz guitar player at a party, and I had been listening to this music for such a long time as a fan. And I guess from an outside perspective, if you don't go into it really young and you're looking at it from the outside, it seems very intimidating. And so the collegiate path of jazz as it's evolved over time, I mean, I think if you look at jazz and its origins, it's obviously like a very grassroots thing, and it was born in the basements of clubs and in back rooms and in people's apartments, and was obviously like a born out of black resistance and black healing and all of those types of things. And so like that, it obviously wasn't born in colleges, you know? And if you think about how it's taught to people now, it's taught in schools. And so the sort of like whitewashing and collegiate treatment of it now is a very different thing. And I think by the time I realized that I loved it, it was probably a little too late in the game for somebody like me to want to try it. And I think a lot of people that maybe would want to try their hand at jazz later in life would look at it and feel very intimidated. And so I think for years I was listening to Abbey Lincoln records almost in secret, really. If I think about it, I would come home and from my day job and put on all of these jazz records and sing along to them and think, God, someday I would love to maybe even just go to a piano bar and sing, you know, a jazz standard or something. And that sort of fire was burning inside of me for a very long time. And I also was a singer-songwriter and played the acoustic guitar and had my own musical endeavors, but never really thought that jazz was something that I would ever really be able to do. And one day I met a jazz guitar player at a party after I had moved to New York, and I was working as a go-go dancer in nightlife and had a day job working in social work at a homeless shelter that specialized in the LGBT community and taking care of people experiencing homelessness between the ages of 13 and 25. And I was like, man, I've always wanted to try to sing jazz standards. And he was like, hey, let's have a session. And I'm like, what's a session? And he's like, you have to realize I have no idea what any of this is. I'm completely dumb when it comes to this stuff. No idea. So he's like, I'll come to your house and we'll play some songs. And I'm like, really? Like, what do I have to pay you? And he's like, you don't. And that was the gift of the music, that it found me. And sort of like that story of the pottery, like when the pottery breaks and it's filled with gold and it becomes more valuable, like when they put it back together and it's filled with gold in order to like make it whole again. Like once the music found me, I was hooked, and I just like pursued it 100% after that.
You go to my head,
head, and you linger like a haunting refrain. Find you spinning round in my brain, like the bubbles in a glass of champagne. Oh, you go to my head like a sip of sparkling burgundy brew, and I find the very mention of you.
So I've read that your jazz singing intersects with your activism as a gay artist, and I was wondering if you could talk about how those two aspects of your identity come together to inform your art.
Well, you have to realize, I mean, I've been an activist since I was a child. When I was 13 years old, I came out of the closet in 1997. And at that time, being an openly queer student in school was a very dangerous thing. And I did an education. I'm from South Florida, in case you can't tell by the two neck tattoos. I did a training video. So there's an organization called GLSEN. They reached out to me because I was one of the only young out students in at the time, I think the seventh grade was when I was out. So 1997, I'm out of the closet in school. I get affiliated with the Gay and Lesbian Community Center and PFLAG, which was the Parents and Friends of Gays and Lesbians. My mom was like, I have this gay child. I don't know what to do. I mean, at the time when I came out of the closet, the first thing my mom said was like, you're going to get AIDS. Like, what are we going to do? This was just like in the wake of the AIDS epidemic. Like, there was so much trauma in America, I think, like coming out of the AIDS epidemic, a gay child and a family, there was a lot of stress, you know? And so my mom went seeking support. And from that, there were so many people in the gay community of South Florida that really surrounded me and loved me. And I got affiliated with a lot of organizations, and GLSEN was one of them. And they made an educational video for the Broward County School Board about why using derogatory language. This is how crazy it was. Why the staff using derogatory language towards students was not acceptable. So they were using, like, the principals and the teachers were using derogatory language about queer people in the classroom setting. This is what was still a commonplace at that time. So I was the first queer student in an educational video in Broward County. Now, fast forward a few months later, probably a year later, actually, they're showing this video all over the country, probably definitely in Broward County. And Fred Phelps from the Westboro Baptist Church gets a hold of this video, and he brings his entire family to my school to protest outside. So they put my name and my face on their website. They come down to South Florida. They picket outside my school, and I counter protest all by myself with my hands up in the sky with peace signs like this. And I make national news. And that was sort of the birth of Richard Cortez as an activist. And so all of these churches, like these Unitarian churches and all of these organizations are calling me and they're saying, do you want to come publicly speak at our organization? And I'm just this kid. I'm a 15-year-old kid. I don't know. What do you want me to talk about? And then they said, well, what else do you do? And I'm like, I also play the acoustic guitar. And they're like, well, come bring your guitar and sing a song and talk about your gay experience. And that was how it all started. So I've always married music and my queer identity as an artist. Fast forward to the jazz part of it. New York City is a very queer place. Jazz is not. It's just not. And when I became a part of it, I slowly started to realize, like, wait, how are all of these Rodgers and Hammerstein songs being played? Rodgers and Hart songs, Harold Arlen songs. And there's no gay people. I'm so confused. I was genuinely so confused. How is there no crossover? So I meditated on this for a really long time. But let's take a step back. So I start my residencies. I was a stripper at the time in New York City. That was how I was making my money. I was stripping at night and working at the homeless shelter during the day. And I started singing jazz as a hobby.
You don't know what love is until you've learned the meaning of the blues, until you've loved a love you had to lose. You don't know what love is. You don't know.
Every place that I was a stripper at, I went to the bar owner and I said, hey, crazy idea. would you let me sing jazz here? And they were like, really? And I was like, yes. And they were like, how's Thursday night? So at every gay bar in New York City that I was a stripper at, I started singing jazz. And you have to realize there's no live music in gay bars, period. So let alone, like, now we're putting jazz in gay bars. This is unheard of. I was the first person to implement live jazz in gay spaces in New York City. So Club Cumming, Rebar, Metropolitan Bar. So my name starts coming up in the jazz scene, but not at the jazz spaces because I'm booking all of the jazz musicians to play at gay bars. This is how people start to find out who I am. So all of these people are like, who is this person? And what is this gay bar jazz thing that's happening? So slowly, this started to happen. The crossover started to happen. My name started to show up on... So think the curse and the blessing that is social media, my name started to show up. All jazz, the jazz musicians started to see, who's the Richard Cortez Trio? What's the Richard Cortez Quartet? Meanwhile, I still have no idea what the hell I'm doing. I don't know how to tag a tune. I have no idea what iReal Pro is. I have no idea what's going on. I'm learning on the bandstand and sound, I'm folding and sounding terrible. It's the first time I'm trying anything. I don't know what I'm doing. I do that for a couple of years. I finally go to Smalls for the first time. It was the most intimidating thing I've ever done in my entire life. But after meditating on this for a really long time, what I realized was the reason why queerness, at least this is my take on it. I'm no professor. I don't have a PhD. I don't have a doctorate. I'm just a stripper that started singing jazz. So take that for what you will. But I believe that the reason why there's not a lot of queerness, open queerness in jazz is because by the time jazz was no longer the popular music in America, that was right around the time that queerness was no longer criminal. So you have to realize queerness was considered a mental illness until the mid 60s. Okay. That was right around the time jazz was no longer the popular music in America as the band, the big band era and jazz as what was on the radio was over. Mm-hmm. So you don't really see the gray area between those two things. By the time queer people could publicly go out into the open and dance and be seen as couples and be a part of society, jazz had already, quote unquote, ended as the popular music and had become a niche thing by that time.
So let's talk about your new recording. Can you talk about the new album?
Them that's got shall have. Them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says. And it still is news. Mama may have. Papa may have. But God bless the child that's got his own. That's got his own.
This record is actually has a queer person on it. Nicole Glover, the saxophonist, is a lesbian. She's another queer artist that I love and have collaborated with. Yes, this is a record through La Reserve. It's called Mood Swings. It's my debut jazz record. So with this record, it's inspired by the fact that I fell in love with this record called Dinah Jams, are you familiar with that album?
Yeah, Dinah Washington and Maynard Ferguson, Clark Terry, and Clifford Brown are on it, right?
But each time that I do, just a thought of you makes me stop before I begin. Yes, I've got you under my skin.
My band, I used to take my bands on, not this current band that's on the record, but a former band of mine that I used to play with. I used to take them on band retreats. And so I took this band on a band retreat to a camp, sort of like a house in New Jersey that had like a campfire. And we were sitting around and they were like, have you ever heard this recording of Lover Come Back to Me? And I was like, no. And they played it. And it's just Clifford Brown and Clark Terry and they're going at it. And it's chorus after chorus after chorus after chorus. The songs are 8 minutes long. Everybody's ripping full choruses. And you know, on a lot of vocal jazz recordings, you'll hear, I don't know, half choruses. The singer comes back in on the bridge. But these recordings, they really stretch live in studio. And that's the concept of this album, is like, it's an ensemble work. It's not just me singing. And I think in a lot of ways it's because when I recorded this album, I was still very green and I wanted to feel supported by a full band, not just I wanted to do something where I felt like we were all standing in line, holding hands together. I didn't want to be the front man. I wanted to be a part of something where I felt like we were all equally showcased. So that's kind of what the sound of the album is. It's like Nicole takes a full chorus on a ballad, which I don't think you really hear a lot of in contemporary vocal jazz. You'll hear a half chorus, you know, whether it's for the sake of the listener's attention span or whatever, but like on God Bless the Child, Nicole takes a whole full chorus. The song is 7 minutes long. So it's like truly an ensemble effort, and that's because of Dinah James.
Oh, you go to my head.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, Richard, and I wish you success with this new recording.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you. Have a nice day.